From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Governor Gavin Newsom said yesterday that a teenager from Lancaster in the Los Angeles area had died of COVID-19. It seems now that coronavirus disease might not have been the cause of death. On the phone with me is Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. Dr. Blumberg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you add any clarity about this case in L.A.?
No, I can't. I don't know anything, any kind of details about this tragic case.
It does raise the question of the connection or separation between sepsis and COVID-19, perhaps pneumonia as well. What kind of science do we have for whatever the interconnectedness might be?
Well, we know that many patients who have viral illnesses, such as COVID-19 or things like influenza, that they can get pneumonia. This can set off an inflammatory cascade that causes acute respiratory distress syndrome, and you can get bacterial superinfection on top of that. So these patients can be quite severely affected, requiring intensive care settings.
So the Lancaster mayor told the LA Times that the teenage boy died of septic shock and that the boy's father is infected with the coronavirus. And this reminded me of an interview I was listening to with Dr. David Persing, the chief medical and technology officer for Cepheid. And that's the company making the new rapid test for COVID-19. So I'm going to play a clip of it. Dr. Persing will refer to SARS-CoV-2, which is the novel coronavirus that's causing COVID-19. But I think it's interesting in the science of these diseases. So here's the comment.
Right now, other conditions that cause pneumonia and sepsis, which are conditions that SARS-CoV-2 also causes, can be easily confused with SARS-CoV-2, but they're right now much more commonly caused by the usual suspects. You know, sepsis could be caused by bacterial infections, severe other viral infections like influenza, pneumonia caused by a whole host of different organisms and infectious causes. What we need now is a way to identify somebody who has SARS-CoV-2 quickly.
And so that's the segue to this rapid test. So, Dr. Blumberg, tell me anything more that you understand about the rapid test and when it might actually get to hospitals.
Well, yeah, there's a whole variety of tests being developed. I mean, we're pleased that we have rapid turnaround time of 1 day with the testing compared to what it was last week when we were waiting 1 to 2 weeks for the results. And this puts clinicians like me in a bind where we have ill patients, we want to provide the best care, and we don't have a diagnosis. So getting a 24-hour turnaround time is a real advantage. Getting a 2-hour turnaround time would be even more of an advantage. And, you know, ultimately what we'd like is what we have now in doctors' offices and emergency departments for influenza, which is a point-of-care test that they can do it right when the patient's in the room and get results in minutes. So that would be a real advance.
How much differently might you handle a patient coming in that instantly tests for sepsis, for example, or pneumonia compared to COVID-19?
Well, we're able to make sure that the therapy is appropriately directed. We're able to make sure that they're in appropriate isolation and that the healthcare workers are taking appropriate precautions. This, of course, helps preserve the personal protective equipment, such as masks, gowns, and gloves that we're hearing so much about with potential shortages. And we're able to stop looking for other diagnoses. So that means that there's less pressure to do even more diagnostic tests because we don't know what's going on with an individual patient.
A key detail in this case in Lancaster is that this was a young man under 18. How concerned are parents? What's the volume of calls coming into your office, to the UC Davis Children's Hospital, about COVID-19?
Yeah, parents are concerned. I mean, we've heard a lot of concern about older adults in the community, so we're all concerned about older adults, grandparents and great-grandparents. But this disease can kill anybody at any age. It is more severe at older ages, but we do expect to see increasing number of severe cases and deaths in children and even in younger children than teenagers.
So Dr. Deborah Birx on the national level shared some global data on March 24th, saying that only one child under the age of 15, and this was a child in China, had died of the disease, and that age group under 50 was only 1% of all the mortality. What do you know now about children and COVID-19 that we didn't know at the beginning?
We've had some early publication of case series that show that it's most severe in children, the children who are less than 1 year of age. And then the second most severely affected age group is 10 to 19 years of age. So between 1 and 9 seems to be the mildest cases. But even so, for those children less than 1 year of age, only 2% of them have required critical care when they're hospitalized for that. So that's still a very low rate compared to older adults.
Are symptoms any different in children and teenagers than they are in the rest of the population?
Children tend to have milder disease. It can be so mild that it's completely asymptomatic.
Okay, Dr. Birx, I feel like I should tap on the flu season too and ask what that's doing right now with children and teens.
Yeah, we're still seeing influenza widespread in the community. We're still getting hospital admissions for influenza. Anybody who thinks they have influenza, you should call your healthcare provider because we do have antiviral therapy available that can shorten the duration of the illness.
Separately from this conversation, there's a headline on the Sacramento Bee today that reads, UC Davis Medical Center staff has some coronavirus cases. Can you describe the extent of the cases?
Yeah, we're seeing cases in hospital staff as expected because we know we have widespread community transmission. So I think the chances of getting infected in the community are much greater than being infected in the hospital setting. We're actively screening, all hospitals are actively screening visitors and healthcare workers for illness. Patients are placed in appropriate precautions. And so I feel that the hospital setting is probably safer than many businesses that are open, such as grocery stores and other stores, where they're not doing this kind of active screening.
In that story, there's a female nurse that believes she acquired COVID-19 from a patient in the emergency department. I have a statement from UC Davis saying that no female employees at the hospital have reported testing positive for COVID-19. There is some clarification about that case in particular. Do you want to expand on that?
You know, I don't have any details of that particular case, but I'm still confident that the chances of transmission in the community are greater than in the healthcare setting.
Okay, we're hearing about hospitals all across the country just imploring the government for supplies. What's happening in the UC Davis health system?
We have adequate supplies of all personal protective equipment at the present time. That's one of the reasons that we want to encourage the public health measures, the social distancing. The idea is that if you get a huge surge of patients all at one time, that this really can result in using up a lot of resources at once. So if you have these measures, the social distancing that can decrease the number of patients at once getting infected, then we'll have enough staff and beds and equipment for everybody when they get sick. We're seeing in New York that the hospitals are getting overwhelmed because the surge is perhaps getting close or over capacity, and we really want to avoid that.
Right. Have you been tested, and are you of the belief that the worst is just ahead of us?
I've not personally been tested. I'm healthy, so we're not recommending testing in asymptomatic patients at the present time or asymptomatic people. Yeah, I do think the worst is yet to come. In New York, the doubling time in terms of number of cases is every 2 days. In San Francisco, in L.A., it's about every 4 days. In Sacramento, it's lower than that based on some small numbers. So we're not having a rapid increase, but once we do, we're going to see a lot more cases, and I expect that in the next 2 to 4 weeks.
All right, Dr. Blumberg, thanks so much for the update. We look forward to being able to call on you again.
Absolutely. Thanks.
That is Dr. Dean Blumberg, infectious disease specialist from UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. Now we're going to focus on a group of people that Governor Newsom has said the state is prioritizing. This is the nearly 110,000 people who are unsheltered in California. And here's what he said in a press conference on March 15th.
Our team's just working 24/7 on this issue to get people out of encampments and get people into environments where we can address their growing anxiety and our growing concern about the health of some of our most vulnerable Californians out in the streets.
So that was March 15th. Faye Kennedy and Bob Erlenbush continue to focus on the city and county of Sacramento, saying it's urgent that more is done. They're on the phone with me now. Faye is the driving force behind the Sacramento Poor People's Campaign and with the Sacramento Area Black Caucus. And Faye, welcome to Insight. Are you with me, Faye?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks. Bob is a well-known activist. He's the executive director of the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness. Hi, Bob. Do we have you on the line as well?
Yes, hi. Thanks for inviting us.
Okay, Bob, why don't you start? What were your expectations coming out of those comments and that March 15th announcement?
Well, our expectations at the local level, having the governor make that kind of announcement, was that there would be serious outreach pretty robust outreach, as a matter of fact, to homeless encampments. Don't forget, I mean, for your listeners who don't know, we have about 10,000 people experiencing homelessness on an annual basis. 70% are outside, no fault of their own, because of lack of shelter and lack of affordable housing. So ballpark, we've got about 7,000, maybe even a little more, people outside. So that's a lot of people to try to pull inside. And we just haven't seen that kind of outreach. Now, private, there has been outreach by the outreach teams. I think some of your listeners may have heard about Crystal Sanchez and the Homeless Union. So there are private efforts as well, but there's nowhere for people to go. The city has not opened up the shelters that they funded more than 6 months ago over on Broadway and X and Meadowview, just for starters.
So, Faye, why don't you add to this? What do you see that is happening since March 15th, and what do you continue to tell the city and county actually needs to be done?
So, great question. So what we are doing, like Bob said, individual groups, individuals are literally going out, engaging folks on the streets in the various encampments, providing them food, providing them water. These are folks that are connected with the Poor People's Campaign, the Sacramento Homeless Union, harm reduction. So we're actually doing the work that the city and county should be doing. And we're constantly sending letters, sending emails. We can't show up at city council meetings or county board of supervisors meetings because of the distancing requirements and because we need to stay inside and shelter in, so to speak. But we're constantly sounding the alarm, but nothing seems to happen in a timely basis. And like Bob said, we have all of these folks who are unsheltered on the street in the cold, in the rain, and pretty soon it's going to start getting warm. And it's just, I don't know, we don't understand why does it take so long for things to happen as condition worsens in terms of the worst case scenario. If the coronavirus takes hold in any encampment, we really are going to be facing some major catastrophe because those folks are already weak with their health conditions. Their immune systems are weakened. And so Sacramento may be facing a major crisis just with the homeless and unhoused population.
I'm looking at a letter, too, from Loaves and Fishes, which is providing some services to people right now, saying the only way for the city and county of Sacramento's recommendation to remain in tents or in their sleeping areas right now is to provide everyone with a tent, to give blankets, to give food, to give information. Is any of that happening? And are you in line with what Loaves and Fishes is asking, Bob? I'll pose that question to you.
Oh, absolutely. The Center for Disease Control a few days ago came out with homeless encampments guidance, and one of the lead pieces of components of the guidance was to stop law enforcement to sort of cease, have a moratorium on shutting down encampments, because then health workers can't find people. So that seemed to have happened with the county park rangers. It's uncertain whether that has happened with Sacramento PD. And so I think that Dr. Bielenson with the county may be issuing a directive to all law enforcement to stop doing sweeps, and hopefully turn those efforts into outreach. So following what Lowe's and Vicious was saying, that people can practice social distancing as best they can by staying in tents. But, you know, don't forget that at the shelter level, it's impossible to practice social distancing when you're in a congregate living setting.
Faye,
we fully support what Lowe's and Fishers was saying.
Faye, one more question. If you drive around downtown Sacramento or the suburbs, there is a noticeable difference in the number of unsheltered people out on the street. What do you think is happening? Where have those people gone?
Well, some of them, so for example, last Sunday I was out. So if you drive down X Street, if you drive down, come up X Street as if you're going towards the Oak Park area, you'll see various encampments there. There are encampments in parks. So we were in McClatchy Park in Oak Park. We saw folks in their tents there. We saw folks hanging out there. And they don't have resources. They don't have water. They don't have food. When they are ticketed by the park rangers or by law enforcement, they're told to go to Friendship Park. They have no resources to get to Friendship Park. They don't have money to get to Friendship Park. They don't have a car to get to Friendship Park. And quite frankly, some of them look so weak that even if they wanted to walk, I doubt if they could make it to Friendship Park or Lowe's and Fishers. So we really have a major crisis on our hands that we hope the community really understands that we have to band together as a community to address the issue of homelessness and unhoused in our community.
Have you heard a direct response from the city or the county to any of your letters this week, Faye?
I haven't.
Bob?
To answer this, Bob, no. And we quite frankly, advocates, including myself and Faye and many others, have been calling for increased sanitation resources for more than a year. And the city's response has been pretty pathetic, to tell you the truth. The mayor of San Francisco a week ago allocated $5 million for sanitizing equipment and materials for homeless shelters. Sacramento City Council last week only allocated up to $250,000. The six porta potties that the city talked about with hand washing stations, those were privately donated. The city didn't spend a nickel on providing porta potties, mobile bathroom and shower programs, trash pickup, et cetera, to people experiencing homelessness. So the city and the county's been worse. They've been missing in action, quite frankly. Now, there are some great people at the county, don't misunderstand me, but I'm talking about the elected official level. Haven't seen any action. But with the health department, they have mobilized pretty quickly to try to identify, try to sort of map out where encampments are, send outreach workers out there to see what their needs are, food, hand sanitizers, porta potties, you know, dog food, cat food, everything that they need to survive, and survival gear, and hopefully providing tents as well.
All right. Well, thank you both. That's Bob Erlenbush, Executive Director of the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness, and Faye Kennedy of the Sacramento Poor People's Campaign and the Sacramento Area Black Caucus. I appreciate your time. We're going to transition here to CAP Radio reporter Scott Rodd in the studio with me. And obviously, Scott, we don't have either the city or the county responding to some of what was just said, although we often hear city and county leaders talk about the plans for homelessness. One of the biggies is the acquisition of hotel rooms to get people into a hotel room setting. What's happening in this region? Frankly, I'm hearing a lot about San Diego, but what's going on in Northern California?
So the state is working with counties on that effort to lease hotel rooms for people who are homeless, who either are unsheltered or maybe in shelters. And they're prioritizing people who are showing symptoms, have tested positive, or are susceptible in some ways, for example, if they're elderly and homeless. Now, as far as prioritization goes, the state is specifically trying to help the seven largest counties try to acquire some of these hotels, or I should say lease these hotels. San Diego has come out, you know, ahead of the pack. They have close to 2,000 that are either leased or very close to being leased. Alameda County, specifically in Oakland, there are several hundred hotel rooms that have been leased. And I've been told, I was told by Allie Sutton, who is the Deputy Secretary of Homelessness for Gavin Newsom, that those individuals are starting to move in now. Where the others are, I've been told that they are negotiating right now, trying to lease these hotels and motels right now statewide. They're up to about 4,000, but the number that they're hoping to get to is much higher. It's in the tens of thousands.
So it's about a priority list right now.
Yeah. You know, looking at some of those urban centers, looking at those population centers, you know, I referenced Allie Sutton earlier, and I want to play a clip that is from our interview just about, you know, how they're focusing on this and who they're hoping to get into these rooms, because I think that's important.
The way we are trying to prioritize these hotels and motels is not to bring everyone indoors necessarily. Our prioritization right now is around symptomatic homeless individuals, whether they are unsheltered or in shelters, who have either shown symptoms or have tested positive, and those that are most at risk if getting it, of having significant complications. So that is where we are trying to prioritize any motel or hotel rooms right now.
So the effort isn't to get every single person who is homeless or every single person on the street into a hotel. There really is a focus on those priority people. Now, as far as the view from the ground goes, there's a bit of a disparity in terms of the state saying that they are working on this 24/7 and moving, you know, full steam ahead, and what folks who are, you know, on the streets, unsheltered or in shelters, what they're saying. I spoke to someone named Rodney Stanhope. He is an unsheltered resident here in Sacramento, and this was his perspective.
We're supposed to be getting these services that the governor keeps talking about here in Sacramento, you know, it's the capital city, but we haven't seen them, you know, and so we're basically stuck out here. You know, it's raining, it's cold, and we now have nowhere to go. So you've pretty much stuck between a rock and a hard spot while the state figures out what it wants to do. And so me and my girl are on the bike trail and our entire campsite soaking wet. So, you know, it's I ended up getting sick from it, and you know, don't know what to do and where to go or anything else. So,
I ended up getting sick from it. Does he mean COVID-19?
No, and no. That's good to clarify. Uh-huh. So it wasn't that, or at least, you know, there was no sign that that was it. But it shows that there is real vulnerability for folks who are, you know, on the streets, especially if you develop a different illness that's going to leave you potentially compromised in a way that you could face more serious consequences if you do contract coronavirus.
He's giving some evidence to what Faye Kennedy and Bob Erlenbush were saying about people not being sure where to go, not being sure where the services are, but there is an awareness anyway. What do we do about solutions here? And solutions are going to be different on the local and community level from place to place than the statewide level.
For sure. The city has made an effort to put out hand washing and sanitizing stations at six locations where there are either large encampments or a lot of traffic for people who are unsheltered or homeless. And the county has also made an effort to hand out, I believe it's over 1,000 hand sanitizer bottles. So that's an effort. I mean, people that I'm talking to, both who are in the homeless community and also on the advocacy side, are saying, you know, we need way more than that. You referenced loaves and fishes earlier. They've had to scale back some of their services and some of their hours. They're still offering some of their core services like showers, laundry, and food to go. But they've said, as you mentioned, you know, we really need a more robust reaction to this and response. There is a long-term sort of plan, though, which I think is an important question that people have, especially in terms of this, you know, effort to lease these hotels and motels. Mm-hmm. And that's something that came up in my conversation with Allie Sutton yesterday. And, you know, she said that they may be looking at trying to acquire these hotels as a more permanent solution in the long term.
So we're keeping a real eye on just the general economic environment that we're in and what opportunities that might bring. Again, a silver lining of all of this, perhaps. So really trying to understand if there's, you know, landlords who would prefer to just be bought out, given some of the economic circumstances, if there's motels or hotels that would like to be bought out, you know, the opportunity to turn this into some permanent housing solutions and adding stock is something we're really trying to keep an eye on as we move forward.
So there is an effort, a long-term sort of goal with all of this, or potential goal, and it's an ambitious one, partly because people are wondering, where is this money going to come from? Governor Gavin Newsom just announced yesterday that, you know, agencies should expect that there is going to be less funding than anticipated with, you know, less economic activity. So where the money would come from for this is still a question. She said that they were looking at several different funding sources, but that remains to be sort of hammered out at this point.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Thanks for being in here. Stay safe.
Take care.
One of the few people in the building today. I'm going to direct you to capradio.org for more of Scott Rodd's reporting on homelessness, also Ezra David Romero, and more stories from the Cap Radio news team. Up next, we're going to shift gears and look at some emerging resources for small businesses across the region. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.